welcome to the November edition of Sipra Speaks, the podcast for professionals working in finance in the public sector. Thank you so much for joining us. We've got a packed episode coming up for you today, and it won't just be my dulcet tones that you'll be enjoying throughout the episode. I have some wonderful roving reporters who've been out and about speaking to our wonderful guests for this episode. So, coming up, we speak to David Phillips from the Institute for Fiscal Studies about their latest report. We dive into the world of data and ethics and what the future holds for local government. And concluding the episode, we're joined by Hubert Wu from the Behavioural Insights team to talk about behavioural psychology and the interventions that are being designed around public sector fraud. But first, I'm here with John Watkins, editor of Public Finance magazine, to talk about the latest goings-on in the news in the world of public finance. Hello, John.
Hi, Ashley. How are you doing?
Yeah, pretty good, sir. So, news-wise, things are pretty crazy at the moment. Obviously, we've now got the third general election in 4 years, is it, that's now been announced. There's lots of numbers being bandied around, lots of promises being made. Labour have now come out and talked about a year of maternity pay. There's been talk of fixing social care. How realistic are all of these promises? How are they actually going to pay for it?
Yeah, general election is obviously getting a fair bit of coverage across our site at the moment. And what's really struck us is the level of spending promises already. Clearly, all parties want to be seen as casting austerity to the history books once and for all. But in this era of fake news and amid the sort of outcry over the validity of some of the pledges and promises made during the Brexit campaign, there's some scrutiny being put now on some of the numbers being bandied around, which, let's face it, are pretty eye-watering. And that's interesting thing for us will be where the money will come from, and particularly what it will mean for the debt level. You know, Sajid Javid has said that if re-elected, the government will borrow £20 billion a year more to invest in major infrastructure projects. And among his set of new fiscal rules, he said the cap on investment will be 3% of GDP, which is considerably above the long-term average of 1.8%. So economists say that we'll see debt rise considerably. The IFS saying the Tories' plans for public investment will reach levels not sustained in the last 40 years. And that's the Tories. Labour, meanwhile, they've pledged some pretty big numbers themselves. So, you know, they've said an additional £150 billion over 5 years via a new social transformation fund to upgrade and expand schools, hospitals, care homes, council houses. IFS says their plans equate to additional spending of something like £55 billion a year. And that's on top of the £250 billion that they've committed to spending over 10 years through the Green Transformation Fund.
So how do you think some of these promises are going to play with people working in the sector?
As you said in your intro, there's an awful lot of pledges being made, and you know, people suggesting that they're going to fix pretty much all of the problems that we have at the moment. I think one thing's for sure is that they realise that, you know, more austerity won't go down well. And so what we're seeing instead is plenty of numbers coming out for how they're going to invest.
So, of course, the general election is the main news story of the day, but it's not the only thing going on for the sector. Recently, the PWLB announced that they were going to be introducing a fairly substantial rates rise. How have things been playing on that front at your
end? That's definitely another big story of ours. Treasury's surprise announcement that it'll be increasing the cost of new borrowing from the PWLB by 1% with immediate effect. That's resulted in a pretty big backlash. I think 36 councillors and mayors came out putting their names to a letter, demanded that the Chancellor reverse his decision or scraps the increase for money borrowed to fund house building and regeneration projects. But you know, meanwhile, the Shadow Communities Secretary Andrew Gwynn, he told our reporters that the government's failure to engage with local government was completely unacceptable. He said it's a shot at councils trying to regenerate the high street and reuse brownfield land. And it does certainly go against, you know, this government's previous stated ambitions to renew our town centres and to use brownfield over greenbelt to provide the housing that the country desperately needs.
Fairly strong words there. Do you reckon that the change from the PWLB is likely to have any sort of long-term impact on council borrowing?
It's something we're looking at the moment. Anecdotally, some people are telling us that they'll look elsewhere for funding. And I think the latest figures that are just out have shown a slight dip already, whether that's a direct result of this announcement or whether that's coincidence in the trends will remain to be seen.
Okay. As we said during the introduction, this episode is landing during International Fraud Week. week.
Interesting story we're running on Public Finance International at the moment out of Budapest. So Hungary is one of the only EU countries not taking part in the EU-wide anti-corruption scheme, which is currently being set up to stamp out fraud and corruption in member states. But Budapest's new municipal assembly, which is mostly made up of mayors from the city's districts, but does also have a few representatives from political parties, that had its first meeting and has adopted its own programme of transparency as one of its first moves. So it's called the Minimum Programme, and it sets out, in their words, the least the government can do to root out corruption and ensure transparency. Many of the guidelines are kind of things that we probably take for granted here, you know, such as publishing agendas in advance of meetings and publishing budgets and making them open and accessible. But given the country's lack of involvement in the EU-wide anti-corruption scheme, it's certainly being seen as hopefully something that will help raise standards of transparency and openness across Hungary if it's adopted in other regions.
So subscribers to Public Finance will have received the latest edition in the last couple of weeks.
Yep.
And the cover feature has been around talent management, which is a fairly prominent issue for the public sector at the moment, given the pipeline for talent in the public sector. Can you tell me some more about that?
Yeah, that's a fascinating story. It's our cover feature in the latest issue of Public Finance, as you say. And it's really about, you know, we're already seeing talent issues and talent challenges in the sector at the moment, but it really paints a picture of just how that is going to increase into the future. Really interesting statistic in that piece that tells us that the current cohort of primary school children joining the workplace in the next 12 to 15 years, 65% of those will go into jobs that don't yet exist. Now, that's all being driven by the fourth industrial revolution, by the rise of digital and technologies such as AI, which are completely changing the skills we will need and the jobs that we will do in the future. The interesting thing for the sector will be, how do we find and attract the right talent we need to do those jobs when we don't yet know what they are? But it also raises some questions about what it means for some of the people working in the sector at the moment who are going to kind of see their careers roll into that period. Will we see that those roles are simply replaced? Or is it an opportunity for public finance professionals to move away from some of the more mundane tasks that can be done by machines to play a much more influential role across organisations?
Okay, John, so for those of our listeners who aren't subscribers, where can they go for more information?
Yeah, they can obviously visit either of our sites, publicfinance.co.uk, publicfinanceinternational.org is our international site. And if you visit either of those, you can register and access lots of our content.
That's brilliant. Thanks very much for joining us today, John.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to the incredibly insightful John Watkins for joining us on Sip for Speaks. Next up, you'll be hearing from one of our roving reporters, Callahan Hager, who joined David Kaplan to talk ethics and the future of data in local government.
You're here with Callahan Hager, and I'm here with David Kaplan, Head of Analytics and Research at SIPFA. How are you, David?
I'm very well, thank you. Full of the joys of autumn.
Good. So we're here today to talk about data and technology, and specifically how it relates to fraud. Can you give us an idea of what the current data landscape looks like in the public sector?
So we've got this move, which is partly driven by technological changes, because we can now do more things with data than we used to be able to, and also the recognition that data is this massive asset that's more than just about presenting the big picture stuff, but it can actually be used to help improve public services, to make them more citizen resident focused, and to make them more efficient and effective.
Yeah, no, I think that makes complete sense. But how much data does the public sector have on file?
So I think it depends upon the relationship. But if you think about your council, they know where you live, they know who you live with if you've got adults, they know if one of you is a student. Other bits of the public sector know about your health, HMRC know what your income levels are. So across the whole public sector domain, there's an awful lot of information out there. Although one of the issues about the use of data in the public sector is it's not probably very ethical to share all of it. And also sometimes there are a lot of boundaries to sharing data. So there's a lot of data about you. And also some creative councils have also combined the information they already have with commercially available information. So for example, some of the people like Experian, who don't have individual data, but they have lots of data about small areas, and combining that with the information the councils can have can be really interesting.
What you're saying is the data resource is actually really huge then.
I think there's a lot of data out there. As I say, there are a lot of issues about accessing it, and there are also questions about how can you make sure that you're fairly processing the data so that you're not using it in a way that abuses the trust of the people who've provided you with the data.
So what are councils actually doing with the data that they have?
A lot of work has been done on using data in terms of fraud prevention. So the idea of data matching in fraud goes back quite a long time. So the idea is you look at the information about the same people on different databases and you can flag up issues about potential fraud. So the most obvious example of that, if a household is claiming single person discount for council tax, if they can be matched with an address that has got two or three names on it in the electoral roll, then that raises a question. It's entirely possible for a household with more than two people or more than one person to claim single person discount. One would only have to be a student, for example, or not permanently resident. So if you add in other demographic data, perhaps possibly data about the area where people live, that can produce a tighter match and make it more likely that a fraud is actually being perpetuated, because the old data matching had quite a high false positive rate, and more sophisticated use of data can reduce that. So I'm aware of one council who, in their first use of bringing together a whole load of data sets, probably saved itself about £500,000 in budget through direct detection of fraud. That probably paid for the first year of operation of their big data warehouse. What we're also seeing now is some more creative uses of data. Some councils are using data to try and identify the general types of child who might be at risk of becoming a child in need or being at risk. These models are being used to target populations for early interventions. So that's quite a positive one in terms of both it reduces the likelihood of a child becoming in need and also reduces the cost of the council, because early intervention we know costs quite a lot less than dealing with the case after it's happened. And building models like this can produce information that you don't necessarily see if you just look at a sort of a crude map of where cases have occurred, particularly if it's something that may be hidden. There are quite a lot of uses going on for data that are now quite creative, but my view is we're scratching at the surface. My favourite example, there's an organisation in Queensland in Australia, and she's brought together all of the local public bodies in the state, and one of the first pieces of work they did with data was actually to identify the best locations or for targeting barking dogs. It was a very important thing to that group of Australians.
I'm sure it would be to a lot of people. And you mentioned the methods as well. Is that artificial intelligence that they're using for this, or is it, I guess, the actual targeting itself?
We hear a lot of people talking about artificial intelligence and machine learning and data science and predictive analytics, but what they're primarily, maybe you'd call it machine learning or predictive analytics, they're just trying to extract, using the appropriate methodology, the best information they can out of the data. Artificial intelligence is slightly different in that with AI, it's actually being designed to be used for decision making. So you could theoretically think about sort of, if you were triaging a child being reported to social care, you could see, well, could you apply an artificial intelligence model to make a decision as to what happens. I suspect that would be troubling to the social care professionals who might want to at least have some form of human intervention. I think in the same way as clinicians worry about using AI only to analyse x-rays or other information or scans, if professionals like to have a look in, so perhaps it's data-assisted decision-making rather than data-driven decision-making.
And David, earlier you mentioned that there are certain issues, whether you're sharing data or things of that nature. What are the barriers that local authorities are facing whenever it comes to using and applying the data?
I think that's a really great question. I think there's a lot of things that people need to think about. The first one, as I mentioned before, is access to data, and it needs to be done ethically and fairly. The other issue with the public sector is the data tends to be held in diverse organisations. So for a council, it might be very useful to have access to benefit data, but the benefit data may be owned by the Department of Work and Pensions. They may not be able to get access to it at all or easily. So the whole idea of data sharing is important, and that requires a legalistic solution. In other words, there may be laws that stop this and stop sharing, and we need to try and work out how to break those down. But they also may be cultural. So people can be very proprietorial about their own data and not want to share it. So I think that's one of the issues. Second issue is to do with data quality. Obviously, models are only as good as the quality of the data that gets fed into the models. sometimes the data's not necessarily as good as you would want it. I mean, I've worked with social care data and education data where you just think this does not make sense. So people, particularly who are completing administrative returns, don't necessarily think there's any reason to make sure the data's great. So that becomes an issue. We've also got to look at the competence of the people who are engaged in doing the activities. And I think that's a big problem for the public sector, who can't quite match the salaries of some of the other sectors who want really good data analysts. I think it's particularly hard in public services, because what you need to do good analysis is you need to be able to combine a great set of skills. They've also got to be able to interpret it, have that sort of statistical inference skill so it makes sense. And then they need to have that framework for how they understand things, through really understanding the subject matter, because otherwise you'll make the wrong calls based on the data. So to get that intersection of subject matter expertise, or domain expertise as some people call it, of the computing skills and the more traditional statistical skills is actually quite rare. You might not be able to combine these in a team, but I think that's a challenge.
Wow, it looks a lot more complicated than I would have expected.
Yeah, I was reading a tweet the other day where someone suggested that a half-day course in statistics was enough, and I don't really agree with that.
So those are kind of the main obstacles and barriers in place for local authorities specifically, but what are some of the broader concerns specific to data in the public sector?
So I think the issues in data in the public sector is very much the ethical use, but a lot of the data, as a citizen, you don't have any choice, but you provide that information to government, and therefore there is a strong moral obligation on the people who are using it to use it correctly. And you do fall into ethical dilemmas. Some councils, for example, are using data and they're anonymizing it as far as they can and using that to build a model, so it doesn't actually relate to any identifiable individual. If it does relate, I mean, if we come back to fraud, is it really fair to use data that's been provided involuntarily to detect fraud? Now, you can probably argue that actually if people are committing an offence, then that's fair enough, but there are questions about fair use of data. The political dimension also can't be understated. Politicians are accountable for what goes on in the organisations of which they're the elected members. They also need to be reassured that what's going on is the right thing. I think there's also, with data, there's this question is, practitioners will turn around and say, oh, I'm not dealing with a statistic, I'm dealing with a person. And I think there's a bit of a battle to actually explain what the value of the data is. And that also requires honesty on the part of the practitioners who are doing the data side to say what we know and what we don't know.
All right. And so you've given us a very thorough and comprehensive overview of the current landscape, the main issues, the main trends. And thank you very much for that. What does the future hold? Where are we going in the next few years?
I'm better at looking backwards than I am into the future, maybe, because I can plot a nice time series. The question of what does the future hold is a really big question. We're going to see more and more councils or more and more public bodies trying to do more and more with data. So you'll see the creation of centres for data analytics. You'll see the creations of analytics teams across the public sector. My hope is that might improve the quality of data, because if you're not working with good quality data, your models are not particularly worthwhile. And I think we will start seeing some really, really good examples of the use of data to drive significant improvements in services. So that should be recognised both by the people who are using those services, so they will get to see things that are more relevant to them and more focused. It will also be more efficient. So whether it be social care, whether it be education, whether it even be your bin collection. I mean, really simple example is a council analysing its complaints about dirty streets. Not particularly sophisticated analysis, but identifying there was a spike at 4 o'clock of complaints when they cleaned the streets 2 hours earlier. What they discovered was school kids came out of school, bought kebabs, made a big mess. So they cleaned the streets 2 hours later, and that's led to a massive improvement in the quality of the environment in that place. So there are examples going on, and we'll see more and more stuff of people using data in a more sophisticated way, using better models. Models will get better as the data gets better, and also as we have more data to feed into them. data will be really seen as a key asset that can be a supporter and a driver of improvements in public services.
So overall, better services, improvements in services, increased efficiency, more uses of data, sounds pretty positive.
I think if we get it right, we can. But there, as I said, we need to make sure that all the cultural barriers to doing this are removed, and also that we don't oversell the benefits and are very honest about what the new world of data science can do and also what it can't do.
Thank you very much, David. Appreciate the time.
You're listening to Sip for Speaks. We hope you're enjoying the episode so far. Next on the show, we have David Phillips from the Institute for Fiscal Studies. My colleague Alison Kroll went out to join him to talk about their latest report into the situation for local government funding.
I'm Alison Kroll, and I'm here with David Phillips, Associate Director at the Institute for Fiscal Studies. So would you mind telling us a little bit about yourself and your organization before we get started?
Great, yes. So my name is David, and I lead the IFS's work on devolved and local government finance. I hope your listeners are kind of aware the IFS is one of the leading research institutes on public finance, on public economics in the UK. And we cover a range of issues, not just local government, obviously, but health, education, tax, public finances, a whole range of things.
So you've just published a new report on local government funding trends. What do you see as the biggest threats to financial sustainability in local government?
Well, I think the biggest threat will be a disconnect between what we expect of councils and the resources we make available to them. And I say that in the context of rising demands and costs for services like adult social care, children's social care, public health, homelessness, vital services for vulnerable residents, and statutory duties for councils to actually make sure they're dealing with these. But at the same time, more reliance on local tax revenues, council tax and business rates, which just won't keep pace with rising costs and demand for these areas. Especially in parts of the country with smaller council tax bases, where increases in council tax just don't raise as much money. And I think that, you know, with councils over the last decade having made big cuts to their more discretionary areas of spending and tried to raise more income from fees and charges, looking ahead, if we see that gap between what we expect of councils and what we're giving them in terms of funding, I'm not sure they can do that anymore, and they may need to actually kind of cut more into these, you know, vital services that vulnerable people rely on.
Labour have talked about free personal care for the elderly, which could cost over £8 billion by 2030. Even the Conservatives are making substantial pledges following a decade of austerity. The magic money tree will need to bloom in a big way. How can these pledges be costed?
Well, I think the first thing to note is that if we want a more generous social care system or more generous local government funding as a whole, it's something we can afford, but only if we're willing to actually stump up the cash and pay for it. So tax and spending in the UK is below the average for Western Europe. And that's mainly because we tax middle earners less. Not we're taxing the top earners, but mainly because we're taxing middle earners less than in the rest of Western Europe. So clearly, if we wanted to raise more revenue, we could do so. The challenge is basically, are people willing to pay more? And can we raise it in an efficient way, a way that people see as being fair? My concern more is not are these things affordable? It's that when thinking about how to raise money, how much we need to spend going forwards, I think there's a temptation always for politicians to promise that will mean more new things, you know, better services, more hospitals, more schools, new shiny things. And one of the things that will happen in the future is even just to kind of maintain our current services, the cost of that will be going up because of an aging population, because of more people with disabilities. My concern is not that we can't find money for a more generous social care system or, you know, new schools, new hospitals, is that in the rush to find money for that, we forget to resource the current services that government provides and council provide in the context of the costs of, you know, even those going up in the coming decades.
You've said there's a risk of local government funding policy and social care coming into conflict. How so?
I think there's potentially two ways in which current local government funding policy and social care policy could come into conflict. The first I've alluded to already, councils are being made to rely more on local tax revenues, council tax and business rates for their revenues, and we just don't think they will keep pace with the rising costs of social care. So the amount of funding in the system might be inconsistent with what we expect to deliver. But I think it's not just about the amount available at a national level. I think it also, there's potentially a conflict between how much is available in different local areas and what we want to get from the social care system. So the government has been moving the funding system to one where there's less redistribution between richer and poorer areas, or areas that are growing faster and areas that are growing slower. And there's more reliance on how much areas can raise themselves through growth in council tax, growth in business rates, through economic development. The aim of that is to give areas stronger incentives to grow the local economy, but if they actually can't grow their revenues for some reason, could be a gap opening up between what they can raise and what they need to spend. But at the same time, I think both Labour and the Conservatives have said that they think we should have more consistent social care services around the country. And I think, you know, there's potentially a conflict between having a funding system, which is about more local reliance, you know, rely on your local sources of revenue, and a social care policy, which is about a more consistent service across the country, when, you know, revenues just aren't the same across the country. So I think there's kind of potentially a conflict between wanting a more local-based funding system, but more national standards in social care.
The level of service you receive from your authority can vary wildly across the country, with more deprived areas often hit hardest by the reliance on a smaller tax base. Your report also highlights how central government spending cuts have disproportionately affected more deprived areas. How can a more equitable level of service across the country be created?
It's true that cuts have been bigger in more deprived areas. But I think it's also important to recognise that spending is still higher in those deprived areas. So it's about 1.3 times as high per person in the areas with the most deprivation as in the areas with the least deprivation. Although that's down for 1.6 times back in 2010. I think this begs the question, what is the kind of fair distribution of funding? Would it be, you know, 1.3 times as high in the most deprived areas or 1.6? Now, the truth is we just don't know. And you can't really answer that question until you answer three questions first. First, what do we expect of local government? What services should provide? What quality do we expect from local services? Second, how much do different parts of the country do different councils need in order to meet those expectations, given the differences in their demographics, in deprivation, in the distances potentially that care workers have to travel between clients? And third, how much are we willing to redistribute between different areas in order to allow different councils to meet these expectations? These questions are being tackled in the Fair Funding Review, but it's not an easy question to answer. It's not an answer you can get just based on analysis. It fundamentally requires a sort of subjective, even political decision about what we think local government is for and how much we're willing to move money around the country to allow different areas to provide comparable services. So services will differ around the country if we allow different areas to make different decisions or if we don't redistribute revenues fully to compensate for differences in needs. But if we try to stop that, we are sort of impacting on local areas' discretion to make decisions themselves. So I think, you know, there is a real question here about the kind of country we think England should be or Britain should be. Is it one where we prioritise central decision-making and redistribution so that services can be broadly consistent around the country? Or is it one where we allow more local decision-making, more local accountability and local responsibility, but recognise that could lead to more variation in what people can get in different parts of the country? It's a big question that, as an economist, I can't answer. Fundamentally, politicians and the public have to kind of say what their priority is.
Choices of how to deliver savings or make spending cuts have differed between authorities. How do you explain this variance?
Well, I think that's actually a really interesting question, and it's one we're only able to really scratch the surface of in our report. Now, what you do see is that nearly all councils have relatively protected social care spending, and then nearly all relatively cut back spending on things like housing, planning, development, transport, and culture. But when you look in detail at the numbers, you see that the scale of the protection or the scale of the cutbacks differs quite significantly across councils, even when you control for the overall cut they face to their budget. And that can be driven by several factors. It could be different pressures being faced in different areas. Maybe in some areas there's a particular issue with safeguarding children, so there's more pressure on children's social care, so we need to fund more money in that direction. It could be based on local preferences. Maybe the politicians, the voters in certain areas care more about some services than in other parts of the country. So we don't know for sure, but we do find some interesting patterns in the work. So, for example, councils in London seem to have cut back social care spending a bit more than you'd expect, given the overall cut to their budget, but made smaller cuts to areas like housing and planning and development. And that might be kind of consistent with the kind of pressures you might think you're being faced in London. We know housing's a big issue in London. We know there's lots of development going on for new housing. And maybe councils have been funding a bit more money in that direction than elsewhere in the country to cope with that. So we don't know for sure, but it does look like councils are responding to the different pressures they're facing in different parts of the country.
While we've seen growth in council tax revenue, This isn't enough to cover the funding shortfall. You suggest councils could be given additional tax-raising powers, such as local income tax, or be provided with additional grant funding. These are vastly different approaches with different pros and cons. What do you think authorities should be leaning towards?
Well, I don't think this is a question I can really answer on my own as an economist, because I think it depends on what we want out of local government again. If, for example, we think that what's most important is that each area has the funding it needs in order to provide a common set of services to a common standard, well, in that case, it probably makes more sense to raise money centrally through a national tax and allocate it to councils in the form of grants based on their need. But on the other hand, if we prioritise giving local areas discretion about what they provide, discretion on the tax and spending levels, and strong incentives to grow the local economy, then in that case, it might make more sense to devolve additional tax powers to councils. And in that case, they have the discretion over whether to raise them and fund additional services or to meet the costs of the ageing population, or if they wanted to hold back and cut back on services. So I think really this is a question again about what do we value more? Do we value having consistent standards across the country for key services like social care and public health? We think these are citizens' rights that everyone should have, no matter where they live. Or do we value more the local discretion that councils can have if they have their own revenue sources? And I think that's a fundamental question the next government will have to kind of grapple with. Because I think sometimes we get this discussion which sort of says, oh, it's very important that local areas make their decisions and have discretion, but it's very important that everything's the same. You can't have that. You can't have your cake and eat it in this world in many respects. And what we do with future funding, whether it's more grant funding or more local tax powers, I think fundamentally comes down to what do we think local government is for? Is it to deliver services at a local level, which are more or less the same across the country? Or is it to make decisions about what those services should be based on local preferences and local needs?
Many thanks to David for taking the time out to join us for this episode. Joining us next on the show, we have Hubert Wu from the Behavioural Insights team. For those of you who may not have been aware, last week was International Fraud Week, so my colleague Kate had the opportunity to join Hubert and Mark McCauley from CIPFA's Counter Fraud Centre to talk about interventions in fraud in public services.
Hello, I'm Kate Latimer and I'm here with Hubert Wu, advisor for the Behavioural Insights team, and Mark McCauley, head of counter fraud operations for CIPFA. Would you mind just telling us a little bit about yourselves and what your role entails?
So the Behavioural Insights team is an organisation which uses insights from behavioural science, and what that is like social psychology, behavioural economics, anthropology, studying how people behave to make policy work better. So within the organisation, I work in our Better Markets team, which aims to work with businesses, governments working in economic policy to help create an economy along with other kinds of policy and other activities that is fairer, prosperous for its citizens. Yeah, so that's me.
Yes, Mark McCauley, CIPFA's Counter Fraud Centre, Head of Counter Fraud Operations. The Counter Fraud Centre at CIPFA launched in 2014 to assist public sector in preventing, detecting and tackling fraud across the public sector, key within local government, and offering guidance and advice, best practice. We produce the annual Counter Fraud and Corruption Tracker Survey, where we survey councils' counter fraud efforts and measure and benchmark across local authorities on how they're performing.
So back in 2012, the Behavioural Insights team published an impressive report on applying behavioural insights to fraud, error and debt. You had some particularly interesting findings around highlighting the risks of dishonest behaviour. Does that really make a difference to people determined to defraud the public sector?
So what we actually did there was, back in 2012, HMRC was running a campaign aimed at increasing tax compliance among certain trades, and in this case there was a campaign which focused on plumbers, and the campaign aimed to essentially give organisations and individuals within these professions an opportunity to settle those on favourable terms. A few varieties of letters were tested, and what we and HMRC found was what you were mentioning in the question. Say, compared to a letter which simply described the plan and what was going on, others which highlighted things such as, say, the complexity of tax affairs, or even highlighting things like discrepancies and the consequences of those resulted in far greater response rates. What I would note is that both what we see empirically and what many areas of behavioural science tell us is that often when we look at compliance, in many, many domains, the vast majority of non-compliance is actually due not to intentional bad behaviour, but often to things such as just the consequences of people's environments or their tendencies. So, for example, people can be busy, can have a tendency to put things off, and often processes can just be complex to the point where it's quite easy for many people to make mistakes. And I think given the roots of some of these things in human psychology, like first of all, that, you know, many things which might look the same as fraud might simply be due to the systems from which that takes place in the first place. But then second of all, I would say that given that there's often much more going on than bad behavior or intentional bad behavior, that also implies that there's a much broader toolkit in this case, even if you limit it to ones related to psychology, that actually can be deployed to basically increase compliance in a way that's very valuable to government. People also respond to, and organizations respond to, like, social incentives and what their peers are doing. There are ways to sort of leverage that to make compliance go up, and even things as simple as personalization have also been shown to basically get positive outcomes.
We've certainly seen a number of those efforts within local authority, and I suppose sending those letters out and what you're testing is appealing to the conscience of the individual and their honest side and saying, look, you may have forgotten to do something, or you've done something incorrectly, you know, or, you know, you had a requirement to declare a change and you failed to, and we believe that there's been a significant change. Therefore, if you tell us now, it's like an amnesty. If you tell us now, we'll correct your benefit. We won't take any further action. And certainly government departments have compliance teams that risk assess instances of alleged fraud and decide whether or not they're going to investigate it because they think it's fraudulent from the outset, or send it down the compliance route and take that type of action. Additionally, upon that, the launch of that paper back in 2012, where they were making their online applications digital, they looked at the recommendations within the report and considered front-ending declarations whereby it would inform you at the outset that the form you're about to complete needs to be true and accurate, and that you, by completing and signing the form, are declaring it's true and accurate to the best of your knowledge and belief, actually deterring people from completing the form at the outset. You're never going to prevent those that are intent on committing fraud from committing fraud. Yeah. However, those that then go on to complete the form will have that in their mind already, and they're more likely to tell the truth from the application. Rather than investing 25 minutes, half an hour, 45 minutes in completing a form and then getting to a declaration and then thinking, well, I've already invested all my time, I may have misled or skewed the truth slightly, but I'm going to sign a declaration anyway because I've already completed the form. So it's definitely a good thing that came out of that report for local authorities.
Interesting. Great that, you know, many of those designs, like the architecture or the processes that, like, individuals and organisations would go through were actually able to just be built from the ground up, it sounds like.
So, as you say, SIPFA is a strong advocate for the prevention of fraud rather than detection and prosecution. How does this resonate with what SIPFA thinks public sector organisations should be doing to combat fraud at its source?
For many years, local authorities have had successful investigation teams that rely on allegations of fraud from members of the public or key data matching exercises such as the National Fraud Initiative run by the Cabinet Office. There are also, for a lot of local authorities, key performance indicators placed on them by central government to detect a certain level of fraud. But we all know that what authorities and the public sector have been able to detect is anywhere between 3 and 5% of the actual loss. You can learn from what you found, and you can use that to identify the root cause of the problem and go back and change your efforts. What we're trying to do at SIPFA is trying to change the thought process to make it geared more towards prevention. Mm. Prevent the loss of the 20 million rather than losing 19 million and detecting one. And even the 1 million you do detect, you may never recover. So if you can prevent a million, you're already doing more and better than you were by just detecting it. So what we're trying to do is change the mindsets of leadership.
Yeah.
Change the mindset and change the tone from the top that the right thing to do is prevent fraud from getting into the system.
Mm.
Put the appropriate controls in place. Have the appropriate checks and balances. We're never going to prevent fraud entirely, we know that. But hopefully we'll reduce the levels of fraud naturally from entering the system.
I'd be curious, Mark, and that was really, just really, really interesting. As your thoughts on like what role detection efforts or certain detection efforts might have in deterring others from doing the same. Like,
it's the psychology aspect, isn't it? If you think there's a chance of getting caught, you're less likely to commit an offence. If local authorities are doing their regular work, their data matching, they've got their fraud hotlines advertised and they are publishing success, if that's publicised, you as a member of the public will see that your local authority or your public sector department that you're getting services from are proactively working to tackle fraud. And you know that there is a risk that should you attempt to commit fraud, you may be found out. The psychology is that you're less likely to do it. So there is the detection of fraud is good as a deterrent, but learning from the root cause and preventing it from happening in the first place is probably more valuable.
Yeah, it's still superior.
However, you shouldn't, once you believe you've reduced fraud, that doesn't mean you should remove those controls. My manager likes to use the example of the detector machines at airports.
Hmm.
They very rarely find anyone with a bomb or a gun or a weapon going through them. But that's because people know that the detector machines are there. But you wouldn't remove them from the airport, would you?
It's a bit like the TV licensed detector vans that apparently go around. And you're always so scared of them. You think, oh, I better keep on top of it. I don't know if they exist. It's just the threat of some van in the distance picking up my non-TV licensed telly. It makes me too scared to not.
Inspectors on the transport network.
Yeah.
You know, you run the risk.
So, Hubert, you've recently been involved with a project around bringing more transparency into market systems. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
The project that you mentioned, Catherine, that shows some very encouraging signs in this direction is one that we worked jointly on with a team at the Crown Commercial Service that piloted the collection of feedback about suppliers purchased by public sector buyers and seeing whether we could implement elements of similar feedback systems that you find in, say, like consumer markets. So what we actually did was we worked with CCS to basically collect feedback about the suppliers that they used. Over the course of a year, we collected around 1,000 reviews, and we asked just a series of like simple questions, such as, you know, did it meet like specifications? And we even included like a subjective star rating of how satisfied the buyer was with the supplier. The first thing we found was that actually when given a chance to look at the feedback which they had received, the vast majority of suppliers actually found it valuable, wanted it to continue, and in the cases where that feedback sort of had an implication for like a change in action, whether there was also suggestive evidence that these suppliers actually did change their behaviors in response to receiving that feedback. We were very encouraged by the use of transparency systems like these, linking it to this system-wide reform that you were talking about, Mark, as like one of many promising system-level interventions that we could use that can both like hold bad behavior to account, but just as importantly also promote really good behavior and encourage that to continue.
Did you say there was a bias with that though? Because is it that people are much more likely to leave a review if they've had a negative experience than if they've had a positive experience?
Yeah, that's a great point. And certain types of rating systems depart from maybe what is objectively true at a population level. But I think what it suggests in a design perspective is that things like star ratings or even written reviews are not a be-all and end-all that will solve every problem in the market. They do bring their own issues as well. And that, you know, I think we believe, depending on the context, often can be solved with very informed and thoughtful design.
What are your thoughts on that, Mark? Do you think methodologies like this have merit in tackling public sector fraud?
Definitely. For many years now, there's been the Local Government Transparency Code that encouraged local authorities to be transparent about what they do, to actually publish the contracts list so that members of the public and competing organisations that have bid for tenders can see who's won the contract, how long it's for, what the value of the contract is. Authorities are now publishing audit and governance committee meeting minutes and decision-making minutes for procurement panels, and actually the public can see why key decisions have been made. There's obviously a certain amount of redaction that takes place, but they can download documents and look at the agendas, look at who's participating, look who's making the decisions. There's also the localism bill where authorities are encouraged as part of the tender process to make it easier for more SMEs in a local area to win business from local authorities. But that transparency, everything being much more available on a platform for the public to check, has made it more difficult. It removes some of the threat. So transparency is a big thing and is definitely good for preventing fraud.
So without one of those three parts of kind of the perfect storm, it makes it much less likely.
If you haven't got the opportunity to commit, it doesn't matter how much pressure you're under to get extra money from somewhere and how you've rationalised it. If the opportunity's not there, you can't commit the fraud.
You can't just do it. You can't do it.
We like to use the... I don't know if it's a five. I always call it the 5-95 rule. The 5% of people that are particularly honest, and then you've got the 5% of people that are intent on committing fraud. They're career criminals. It's what they do to that's their living. Mm. And then you've got the rest of us that are 90% in between. That should an opportunity arise, you may be tempted. And you know, I'd like to think I'm in the bottom 5%. We all are. But in reality, can you resist temptation if an opportunity was put before you?
Yeah, fascinating. And I feel like one of the really intriguing things about that framework is if you look at that fat 90% in the middle, I think it seems like there are some parallels to this idea that like the world is just not as clear as almost perfect, or you're dead set on doing the wrong thing. Mm. And I think that's quite encouraging.
And there's been people do criminal studies for their master's degree that get published that have looked at behaviour and looked at what is in the mindset of a fraudster. And this behaviour insight research that's done by yourselves helps the practitioners and people like me and fraud managers and people within, you know, the counter-fraud realm look at how we can use the knowledge of people's behaviours. We can prevent fraud from happening by, you know, some subtle changes to what we do.
Well, thank you both very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Bye. Great.
Thank you.
Some fascinating insights there on the impact of fraud in public services and some fascinating work going on in the sector to try and combat it. That's all we've got for this episode. We sincerely hope you've enjoyed it and we'll tune in again in December to get the inside scoop on the latest in public finance.